All right, this is the 20th of February 22, and we're getting into Isaiah 36. I want to show you our main character today. This is the emperor, king, whatever you want to call him, of Syria. Assyria. And the reason we know what he looks like is here. Because we have a great deal of information for this story that we're going to have. In many, many times in the Bible, we have to rely on faith. We have to say, okay, well, I believe that this happened. You know, we don't have any evidence about the loaves and fishes. There's no fish bones laying around anywhere, or, you know, archaeologically discovered crusts of bread or anything like that. I mean, we have to usually rely on faith, but sometimes we get archaeological and historical data that backs up the story, which I really enjoy when that happens, especially in the Old Testament. So we have evidence. We're going to do a seminar on this coming up in a few weeks after Break Free is done. We'll do a couple Wednesday night seminars. But this is the story of Sennacherib and Hezekiah. So we've done 35 chapters over a year of study of Isaiah. And it has typically been poetic and prophetic and amazing. But now we come to a space in the book of Isaiah where we switch gears. Now, I forgot to bring my notebook where I had written down all of these times that they do that. But there are a great number of switches where you go from a description of something that is done in a prose style to the poetic prophecy around it. For instance, if we go back to Isaiah 4, from 3 to 6, the end of Isaiah 4, you'll see that it is a story rather than a poetic, prophetic thing. At the beginning of Isaiah 6, you'll notice that. At the beginning of Isaiah 7, in fact, most of Isaiah 7 is like that. The beginning of Isaiah 8 is like that. The end of Isaiah 8 is like that. So it's not uncommon for this to happen in Isaiah. Interestingly enough, this one is by far the longest because it runs for quite a few chapters. In essence, there is a couple breaks of like things that are in there, but in general, it's going to run from 36 to 39 with a little break in the middle, some poetic, prophetic stuff. Now, I think that due to the location, so we're doing like textual analysis right now, overview. I think that due to the location, which is roughly the middle of the book, 66 chapters, this is in the 30s, right? I think that due to the length of the prose that's here, the historical description, and what happens afterwards, starting in 40, going to the end, we have almost no breakdown like that. Only once or twice does it do that. So the rest is very much poetic prophecy. So looking at the whole book, we could say, A, that this is probably the most important part when it comes to historical descriptions. Not when it comes to the word for us and things like that. That could be throughout the book. Or the messianic parts, which are the most important parts. But when it comes to the historical time frame of Isaiah, this is a really big deal. Another reason for that, for thinking about that, is because this gives us some really concrete, literally in some cases, some really concrete connection to the rest of the world. So if someone says, well, that story about David is really cute. I mean, there's a little farm boy and he plays the lute and he goes and he kills a giant with a rock. I mean, that's cute. Then if we don't have like evidence of any of that, and we have very limited evidence of any of that, then it is makes it more difficult to say the Bible is biblically, you know, historically accurate. It's historically accurate. It's a historic document in a lot of ways. But when you hit things like this, and lots of other things, lots and lots and lots of other things, when they cross-reference, it gives you the ability to go, okay, check this out. Here's Sennacherib. So we have a name of a king, and then we have a name, you know, we go and we say, okay, well, if Sennacherib is the king of Assyria, and Assyria is about to attack Jerusalem here in Isaiah, that should be somewhere else because they have records. The Assyrians kept records. The Assyrians would have to keep records because they would have all these people that owe them money. They have to send them money and all these other things. And how would I know if I have it collected from so-and-so province, right? I would need records. And so we do have records. In fact, we have some really great records. And Sennacherib has an entire thing we call a stele, S-T-E-L-E, which is this big stone explaining his exploits and all the things he conquered. And we have a bunch of, you know, information about that, and it cross-references. And then when you look at some of the mentions of the kings from other people, like when, you know, Syria is coming together with the north or all these other things, you find records in other cultures. And that's a pretty big deal to build a track that like that. Well, for me, I love stuff like that. There is virtually no historical argument that this happened. Obviously, atheist historians have question marks about the angel part, but there is no argument historically. The exact year, everything in BC is plus and minus a little bit, because it's difficult to figure out exactly what's happening. But but we're real close to about 701. We're just inside the 8th century BC. But I'll show you what that looks like. And of course, it's crazy looking, obviously. But this is a book written in stone. That's what it looks like in real life. We have that sitting there in real life. Right. And that writing is why archaeologists use those little brushes and take forever to do stuff. Because you can never tell if that plate right there is gonna have, you know. And some of those things, such as the Rosetta Stone, have changed the whole world. If you found one that had it written in two languages and you didn't know how to translate between the two languages very well, it could solve the whole problem. So anyway, Rosetta Stone had it in multiple languages and solved a lot of problems. This is why we need to update translations. We don't have to. We can go with the very first translations. We can go with Jerome or whatever we want to do. But the reason we update things from the King James to the New King James, because we're always learning more about language. We're always learning more about Greek and Hebrew. We're learning more about what certain words meant and how certain things were presented. And it's enabling better and better translations and more understanding of what the text says. Whenever there's an error in the text, it's us trying to translate and understand it. It's never the text itself. God says whatever he says, and we try to figure out what it means. And sometimes we get it really right, and sometimes it takes a while to get our head around it. One of the things we talk about a lot is the ancient Hebrew of Genesis, which makes introduction into Genesis for regular, you know, agnostic type people very difficult, because in English it doesn't read as scientifically accurate as it does in Hebrew, which is astounding to some people to think about things like that. But anyway, in this case, we have a firm establishment. So the next reason that I think that it's such a big deal is because it is the example. Isaiah is full of everything that's going to happen and all the stuff that has happened, all these things. But this is sort of like the example of what he's been trying to say. Here comes a giant army. How do you act? God says he's going to take care of it. How do you act? Then he does take care of it. What do you think about that? How do you act, right? That's sort of the point. And so now we're on to the actual story of what actually happens. I think that the reason that we have so little of this prose style after this, after Isaiah 40, is that it's the reaction time. After that, nobody has any options. I don't know about Isaiah. I know Isaiah had absolute faith. I don't know if he was seeing visions of it or if he was hearing words from God, but he absolutely understood and had faith of what was happening. Isaiah had one quality. Well, he has lots of great qualities, but he had one central quality. He just did whatever God said. If God said, name your kid this, he did. If God said, walk around without clothes for 3 years, he did. I mean, he's whatever God says. So the kind of person that would do that is the kind of person that really gets who God is. Like, I mean, we get a little bit about who God is. We understand the concept of what we're talking about. But to really, really get it would mean if God said, hey, I just need you to walk around naked, you'd just be like, okay. And then everybody else would be freaking out, but you wouldn't care because God. You know that no matter what happens, God's got a plan and he's going to work it out and something's going to happen. In this case, it was a part of the prophecy about the people being taken away, stripped and bare. That's back in like Isaiah 20 or something like that. 12. Anyway, so now it came to pass. So now we've done all this 35 chapters of getting ready, and hopefully people did. And here we go, 36. Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against him and all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Okay, so now another thing that would be nice to do is cross-reference, if you can, within the Bible. So we actually have this record back in places like Kings and Chronicles. So if we go back to 2 Kings 18, right, we are going to see. So this is big deal no matter what you're writing. So this is our story back in 2 Kings 18. So now Hezekiah has taken over. He's the son of Ahaz. He's the king of Judah. He's 25 years old when he became king. He reigned for 29 years. We could be pretty sure that that information is accurate, although you never can tell if a date is when they're reigning or when they're born or when they're dying or whatever. But anyway, so this has given us a background back in 2 Kings of who Hezekiah is. That's why I wanted to direct us there. Because he removes the high places and broke the sacred pillars and cut down the wooden images and the bronze serpents. And he's trying to, so what Hezekiah is doing is trying to purify. I'm assuming that he's hearing from, I'm assuming that he's going to hear from Isaiah, because we know when we get back to Isaiah that he does. But I'm assuming that he's hearing from Isaiah the whole time. My assumption is, And we can't be 100% sure because the very first section of Isaiah talks about all four kings. So how was it written? How was it put together? I'm relatively certain that Isaiah wrote everything. And I'm relatively certain that he had plenty of time to do so. He lived about 100 years or whatever, right? So he's got plenty of time. He probably also had plenty of help when it comes to scribes and things like that because he's such a very important figure. But the 35 chapters before this, he's been preaching, and I don't know if he's just writing it or if he's expressing it, but I'm assuming he's expressing it to the people because he talks a lot about this is what God says to the people, right? This is what God wants you to know. I'm assuming that he's saying that, and I'm assuming that Hezekiah is the type of person that's listening. And Hezekiah is the king. He's getting all these messages from everywhere, such as messages that say, hey, these guys are attacking in the north, or these guys are taking this city and that city. So, for instance, in 18:9, 2 Kings, now it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hosea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmanazar is the king of Assyria before Sennacherib, came up against Samaria and sieged it. This is the story that we first started with, where the north was trying to get the south, Judah, Jerusalem, to band with them, and they wouldn't. And then they tried to attack them. But before they could ever attack them, the Assyrians took them out. So they're going through this whole battle. The king of Assyria carried Israel away captive to Assyria. And this is part of the beginning of Isaiah. Then in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, this is 18:13, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will pay. And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave him the silver which was found in the house of the Lord, the treasury of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple, from the pillars. So Hezekiah is doing king stuff, trying to, you know, assuage this foreign leader who's taking over everything around him. Okay. Then the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsari, and the Rabshake from Lachish with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah. Now, so this guy, Sennacherib, is just beating down the Holy Land, okay? And if you look at the map, it's hilarious because it's everything. Okay, it's the entire Fertile Crescent, with one exception, a small circle around Jerusalem. Okay? He's all the way down in this map, and I don't know how accurate that map is because it's just a line. But in this map, he's all the way down into Ethiopia. He's all the way from, you know, Persian Gulf, border of India, you know, give or take, all the way over to, like, Ethiopia. This is an absolutely insane empire. It looks like it goes all the way into Turkey, past Tarsus. So now, it's fascinating, and I want to pay very close attention. It's going to take us a few weeks to get through this. I want to pay very close attention because I want us to compare Sennacherib eventually to Cyrus. It's going to come later. And it's fascinating. The story of Cyrus is one of the most baffling. There's several baffling stories in the Bible where God seems to be having like his person, but it's not like his person, but it is his person. And it's hard to explain. You know, I think about this a lot, primarily because of Gandhi. I don't want to sound crazy, okay? But God uses people that aren't necessarily in his group. And sometimes in really, really big ways. And they don't necessarily know what's going on. And they often credit the wrong thing For instance, Marduk, who is the god of Babylon. And we don't know that whole much about that whole mythology of Babylon. But we know that Cyrus, this is going to come up later, that Cyrus is hearing from God because of the Bible. But then we know that Cyrus thinks it's Marduk talking to him. So do we think of that as cultural, or is there a demon involved somehow? I mean, what does it mean? This is a really big theological, philosophical, historical question. Like, it's very difficult to figure out some of these things. Sennacherib is not confusing like Cyrus, but God uses Cyrus to send the people back from their Babylonian captivity. This is 100 years or more after this happens. And we're getting to that. But the comparison of the way in which the two rulers act and how they're used by God is very interesting. So just keep that in the back of your mind. Because Cyrus is not like Sennacherib at all. Sennacherib, so let's get back to it. So he took all the fortified cities of Jerusalem, and among them is this major one called Lachish. Now, Lachish is a city that is very real and very fortified, and archaeologists are working on it as we speak. And it was one of the biggest defense cities, most fortified, most dangerous. And he takes it and crushes it, and it's a very big deal. And he sets up shop there because it's the biggest, one of the most biggest, powerful fortified cities. And so he's going to send these envoys and these people that are going to be coming in to sort of scare King Hezekiah, or whatever you want to call it. But the Rabshakeh, and I don't know how to pronounce that, of course, but the Rabshakeh, which is probably related to Sheikh, it's probably related to Sheik, but the Rabshakeh is a very scary individual, like an advisor, personal advisor to the king, somebody that would be very impressive, that would travel with a very impressive entourage. He's going to come with a great army. Look at this. He stood by the aqueduct of the upper pool on the highway to Fuller's Field, and Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joan the son of Asaph the recorder, came out to him. So you remember those guys, because we had talked about them way back. They were almost like symbols earlier in Isaiah, but they are real people. One of the things that immediately strikes me is how exactly specific this is. This is not like, and they came to Jerusalem and stuff happened. This is like, at the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to Fuller's Field. I mean, that is like within this room. That's how specific that location is, right? And Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and John the son of Asaph the recorder, came out to him. Then the Rabshakeh said to them, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust?" Now, this is a great opening line. What is the number one attack on all of humanity always? The number one attack on all of humanity always. Every single person that ever lived, Adam to, you know, my great-grandkids, if I have any, right? It's always the same. Right. Yeah. Who are you putting your trust in? Are we sure that God said not to eat that particular fruit? I mean, let's go through it. You know, God said, don't eat that tree, but he didn't even mean that tree. And one of the fruits is slightly greener, and one of the fruits is slightly redder. Did he mean both the green and red fruit, or is it just the red fruit? Because it seems to me like, and this is the devil talking to every human being, or with one of his minions, talking to every human being that ever lived. The idea is to question your faith. Because God's not standing right there beside you, right? And the reason is, if God was standing right there beside you, they would already be disintegrated, okay? But you're going to have faith. If the jackbooted thugs of the new Nazi regime kick the door in and grab us all, we're going to have faith. We're not going to see, usually, sometimes we will, but we don't necessarily see angels. We don't necessarily see anything. People that get defended, a lot of times they don't see what's happening. Sometimes the prophet will see the army. That's where the, those that are with us are greater than those that are with them. That part comes through, which is really, really cool in another part of the Old Testament. But the point is that we have to have faith. And so if we're having faith, it can be questioned. It can be attacked. Are you sure? I know you say God said he would protect you, but are we talking about right now? Because I have a spear. It's looking unlikely that you're going to be protected right now. So they can bring this attack, and this is what happens on every college campus every single day, right? I'm not mad at college campuses. I love college. I have lots of degrees. But the point is, that's what happens every single day. The only reason that I made it through anything major at any major university is because I like fighting. If I was like a non-confrontational pacifist guy, I couldn't survive that because they mock you for faith, right? So if you don't have the ability to stand in that type of fire, because God is with you. So that's what he's doing. He's saying, look, have you seen this army? Have you seen how big this is? And you guys have, 17 guys with sharpened sticks? I mean, really, who are you putting your faith in and why? He's questioning his faith. He's trying to get him to go, you're right. Because a lot of the kings have gone, maybe God's not going to help me. So this is what the Rabshakeh says to him. What confidence is this in which you trust? I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. Now, in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Look, with an exclamation point, look, you're trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and all who trust him. So now that's part one of his attack. Remember the people that snuck out that went down to Egypt to talk to Egypt. So obviously Sennacherib and his guys have either captured these guys or have spies that have watched them go out of Jerusalem to get Egypt's help. And Egypt's not going to help. As he describes Egypt, Egypt's a broken reed. If you count on the broken reed, it's going to break and it's going to pierce your hand. So in other words, you're going to get hurt if you count on this broken reed, you're going to get hurt. That's part one. You can't count on any other people. And that's an attack we get all the time too. Can't count everybody. Every single human being has bouts of depression of some kind where they feel alone, like abandoned. That's the enemy. And one of his things is to get you to feel alone and abandoned. If he can isolate you, this is why Jesus was in the wilderness. If he can isolate you, you got no help. Of course, Jesus was God and didn't need any help. But a human being, 40 days in a wilderness, the devil's going to break this person down almost every time, right? So this is what's going on. The first thing is you can't trust other people. What do you trust in Egypt to help you? But then it continues, 36:7. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places, whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar? Now, I don't fully understand Hezekiah's activities when it comes to that. I think that they're trying to focus the power. That the point is, this is the temple. Because theoretically, and like I said, I wasn't there and I'm not a Levite, okay, from 800 at BC. But theoretically, here's the deal. Jesus hasn't come yet, not for 700 more years. So where's God? And God has got a place, a seat, on the Ark of the Covenant that's in the temple, in the Holy of Holies. And this is where God comes to be with his people. So if you start taking down all the other random things and making everybody go to the temple, then what you're doing is getting them closer to God. And I don't know if that was his motivation or what, but you're getting the people closer to God. In reality, this is bringing everybody inside. It's bringing everybody inside of Jerusalem. It's getting them under the protective, because it's going to become protection. Being inside Jerusalem is going to be their protection. So, but it appears to be, you know, disgracing those areas, right? So he's using that like that. He's saying, look, Hezekiah doesn't even care. He's been taking down all this stuff and trying to bring people here. Now, therefore, I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses. If you're able on your own to put riders on them, how then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord against the land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. So he's got three sets of attacks, and they're all playing out every single day of every human's life. The first attack is, you got nobody you can count on. The second attack is, you can't count on the Lord. And why can't you account on the Lord? Because you're not good enough. You haven't done the right things. Why would God help you when you're taking down high places? Why would God help you when you did that stuff in college? Why would God help you when you weren't faithful to whatever, right? So first thing is, you can't count on people. Second thing is, you can't count on God. And not only can you can't count on God, here's why, because you suck. Why would God help you, right? And then finally, I heard from God, he said, come kick your butt, which is awesome. Like, this is just awesome. Because we're forever, especially evangelical Pentecostals, are forever hearing from people that hear from God. And sometimes that's true, right? I've had a lot of times where I've heard from God, or people around me have heard from God. A lot of great miracles happen like that. But that's not easy. That's not hard to make up. Hey, I heard from God that you should try to grow your hair out, or whatever. Whatever it is. Hey, I heard from God that you should give me a bunch of money. I mean, God said if I don't get $1 million in a new jet, he's burning the whole city down. So y'all better start writing checks. That's happened before, by the way. I can't remember which guy it was. Maybe one of the guys said if he didn't get another jet or something, God was going to do something bad. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm sure God is talking to you about your jet, your fourth jet. That makes total sense. But this is exactly what this is. It's all the attacks that we face. And notice it's not Isaiah or Hezekiah. What do I mean by that? Well, Isaiah is the man of God. If they start speaking to him like this, he's going to laugh in their face, because he really does hear from God. And Hezekiah is the king whom God has placed in this place at this time and empowered. So neither one of them is going to just listen to this nonsense. But these guys are the servants. They're not as powerful. They're not as close to God, right? So he has a chance to kind of get under their skin. And he's like, tell you what, if you guys will make a pledge to the king of Assyria, I'll give you 2,000 horses. Now what he's saying is, we got so many extra horses, I'll give you a couple thousand horses. And then he goes on to say, if you could even put riders on them, which they probably can't, right? He's saying, you can't even put riders on 2,000 horses if I give you the horses. And that's the force of one of our captains. So you couldn't even fight one of our captains with that force if I gave you the horses. So he's saying, it's at least 20 to 1. We don't know what the numbers are, but it's like something like 20, 30, 40 to 1, right? He's like, you guys are so dead right now. And so Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it, and do not speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. This is fascinating. Right. They don't want the people to know what it's saying. So he's saying, they're saying, can you please speak to us? Because they're the highly educated. They speak Aramaic, which is a broader language. Hebrew, which is related, but it's an older language, is the language that the Israelites themselves speak, right? This guy, first of all, we need to realize that the Rabshakeh is able to speak all these languages. So this guy is really smart and really a big deal, this Rabshakeh guy, right? Because he can speak all those languages. And he comes to them and speaks to them in Hebrew, which he shouldn't even know. So this guy is way past, like, this guy is like, if there was a senator that was also the head of a college that was also a lawyer. Like, this is the level of this guy. Like, he's next level. And he's talking to them in Hebrew because he knows that they are the people of God, and he's speaking to them in their own language. And they say, hey, can you talk to us in Aramaic, which is a broader regional language? But that's a language that the people in the city and the people up on the walls watching don't necessarily speak. But they can speak it because they're highly educated people too. So it's like, oh, okay, can you speak to us in this language? Because then these other people won't understand what you're talking about. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. Probably it's to control panic, because they're basically advisors to the king and scribes and stuff like that. So they're probably trying to stop the panic that would ensue when the people on the wall hear what he's saying. But let's continue. But the Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you? So he denies their request and says, I want everybody to hear what I'm saying, because they need to know that we're coming to get you. Okay. Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out with a loud voice in Hebrew and said, hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. The city will not be given in the hand of the king of Assyria. Quote, do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present. Come out to me, and every one of you eat from his own vine, and every one of you from his own fig tree, and every one of you drink the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. So this is sort of basically the ultimate lie from Eden being repeated, right? And he's using every trick in the book. His main plan is to break their spirit, because then they won't fight at all. Even if Hezekiah says fight, they won't fight. And cut off their reliance on their king, cut off their faith. And we don't know how many people are up on those walls, but it's probably a lot. If a big giant company of the enemy comes to the gates, right, and the guys from the city are meeting with them, probably everybody that can fit up there is up there watching, trying to figure out what's going on. They're going to run back, and they're going to tell their friends and their family and their friends. He says, if you guys will make peace with us by a little present, just give us a little something, something, okay? Nothing too big, right? It's okay. Then we're going to take you to a place that's like paradise. It's a beautiful place where there's free-flowing everything, and it's beautiful and perfect, which is an absolute lie, right? The whole thing is an absolute lie. But this is what he says in 36:18. Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Now, this is exactly what Hezekiah is about to do, because that's exactly what's about to happen. So what he's doing is turning the words of of God and the people of God on their head and saying, hey, beware when he says this, because so this is setting up doubt in their mind. So when Hezekiah and Isaiah say God's got this, there's going to be this doubt in their mind. And this is the big attack. Break down their faith, break down their spirit so that they don't believe when that happens. This is the next move. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? It's a question, right? And the answer is no. All of the lands have fallen to the king of Assyria. From Ethiopian Egypt all the way around to far Persia, everything has fallen. So, if that's true, then what makes you think your God's any different, right? Now, this is a beautiful attack. So check this out. And it's also got a massive flaw, which we'll get to in a second. Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Sepharvaim. Man, it's hard to say some of these words. Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? He's saying, look at this. These guys had a god they prayed to. He said he was going to help them, didn't help them. And these guys, and these guys, and these guys. He's showing the one flaw that he has, because his attack is very strong. He's a very smart guy, speaks all the languages in the world, right? He's really cool. But he has a flaw. And his flaw is he thinks all his gods are the same. Everybody's got a god, and the guys in Jerusalem have a god, and the guys over there in Samaria have a god, and the guys over there in Elam have a god. Everybody has a god. That's not how it works. They don't have gods. They have images and carved rocks and things like that. We have the God who created the universe. It's a different deal. It doesn't get that, right? So in 21... But they held their peace and answered him not a word. So this is the gods. All these people have spoken to their gods and said, hey, help us. And they held their, but the gods held their peace and answered him not a word. For the king's commandment was, do not answer him. So now this is, we're switching over. So these guys, okay, so none of the gods helped anybody. Now, what are these guys, Eliakim and those guys, going to do? What they're going to do is they're not going to say anything. So he's explaining his point and doing it loudly to everyone. But they don't do anything. So the people that are there, the representative of the king, they held their peace and answered him not a word. For the king's commandment was do not answer him. So Hezekiah has told them when he starts saying crazy stuff, don't answer him. Well, that's fascinating, right? Because that would mean that Hezekiah would know what he was going to do or say, right? Maybe he knows that he's going to make demands and he doesn't want them to respond. Then Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe and Joan the son of Asaph the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of the Rabshakeh. All right, Isaiah 36. So, great scene. Would make an awesome movie. The Rabshakeh pulls up. He's got all these guys with him. He says, we're about to destroy you. You gotta come up with a plan and surrender. They say, can you speak to us in Aramaic so you don't freak out everybody up on the walls? And he's like, no, as a matter of fact, I'm going to climb up on top of this thing and yell at everybody on the walls. Hezekiah is a fraud. Your God is a fraud. Everywhere we go, everybody says, oh, their God's going to help them. They never do. We crush everybody. You guys are about to be crushed. And then they don't respond. And they are brokenhearted and scared and freaked out. So they tear their clothes, which is what you do when you're just like in mourning and you lose your mind. Like you just rip your clothes and you go throw yourself down in front of the altar and stuff like that. So they do that and they run off. Now they've done their job, which is to go meet him, to hear their offer, the offer of the enemy. They tried to control the panic, but they were unable to. It probably made it worse, right? And now they come to Hezekiah and tell him what has been said. Now, this is all part of the plan. The fascinating part of this is that this person says many lies. Also, this person tells them he's creating the fear as much as he can and then yelling it to everybody. So what we have in the Rabshakeh, or the Rabshakeh, or however you pronounce it, I don't know. What we have in the Rabshakeh is the ability, basically he's representing the dark side very well. He's utilizing the tools. He's doing it the same way. And he's very much a representative of the enemy, the way he's presenting it. And he's doing, kill, steal, and destroy, right? The enemy comes but not to do nothing but kill, steal, destroy. It's exactly what he's representing. The father of lies, the father of deception is what the devil is. That's exactly what he's doing. So he's using deception. He's using lies. He's basically doing the playbook. Now, obviously, the people are gonna freak out. Okay, and it's not cool because it is a giant enemy army and it is really bad. And he has conquered everything that he's come up on, so it looks really bad. Which is the time for faith. Here's the good news. The good news is, from the beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible, and in all of our lives every day, the enemy has a series of flaws. Very, very good tactics. Very, very good at breaking us down and destroying our lives. Very good at that. But here's the flaw. The enemy is not creative. God is a creator. God is a creator, a creative God. We're designed in the image of God. So we have creative capabilities. We can write books and make music, right? The book in front of us is an example of the fact that human beings are in the image of God. The enemy is not creative. So what that means is the tactics remain the same. It's horrible, but it's kind of good news because it means that if the tactics remain the same, we should be able to recognize them. If the enemy comes up against us the same way from the same direction all the time, we should be able to recognize it and therefore fight it off. So the reason that this is being told so carefully is because of what it represents, as well as what it is. But what it represents. How are they going to come at us? The same way. We're fortified. We're here in Jerusalem. We have the Holy Spirit with us. We're believers. We're a fortification unto ourselves. We got the whole armor of God working. We're fortified. They're coming to attack. How are they going to attack? Part one. They're going to say, You can't count on anybody. The closest people in your life are not, you can't count on them. They don't do what they need to do. They're not going to support you in times of trouble. They can't be trusted. And then God, you can't count on God. God has let you down before. He'll let you down again. And they're coming with this same stuff. And think about everything you're up against. How are you supposed to do anything when you're up against so much more than you're capable of? You're up against like bills and taxes and losing jobs and diseases and problems and family issues. And it's just this giant pile. You can't possibly fight against that. And these are all the attacks. And they're the same ones. They go all the way back to the beginning. Oh, well, God doesn't want you to eat that thing because that'll make you as smart as he is. And then, you know, he can't be God and just lord over you. And it's a misrepresentation of who God is. It's always close, but it's a misrepresentation. Because they do have an army. This is bad. It's not like, oh, life is really good and they're trying to describe something completely false. No, life is really bad. You know, they are in serious trouble right now. But all those pieces of that puzzle, you can't count on your leaders. You know, this is a great one that we're all on right now. The attack of you can't count on your leaders, don't listen to your leaders. I think we're all pretty much in agreement that we can't count on our leaders, right? I mean, I don't know how much the enemy has to do with the current leadership of America and how much God has to do with the current leadership. I don't know how that all works, but I know that it's all spiritual. And I know that as we sit here, I can't speak for you guys, but I'm not incredibly confident with my leadership anywhere, except maybe within Radiant Church. I'm pretty confident that Pastor Todd's about to say something that matters. But other than that, I'm not very confident in the mayor. I'm definitely not very confident in the governor. And the president can't put a whole sentence together. So I'm definitely not confident in his ability to run, like, I don't know, let's like a war with Russia. Can you even imagine the current administration being in charge of a war with Russia? What do we do? Just give up and run away and hide in caves? I mean, I guess that's pretty much what's going to happen if that happens. I mean, that's not going to happen, probably, right? But I don't have, I mean, that's an attack. Whether it's the setting up of the wrong leaders, which happened over and over again in Israel and Judah, or if it's losing faith in the leader you have that is faithful, either way, that's a breakdown. That's a way to break you down. If you don't have any friends and you can't count on God and you can't count on your leaders, you're isolated. You're literally alone and you're up against an army. So the party's over. And we're taking these hits every single day. The whole development of the nobody can trust anybody thing from the last 5 years, 10 years. It's like it's a move of the enemy. That's why Radiant and a bunch of other churches are getting so strong in their words and their presentations. That's why God is instructing all these pastors around the world to ramp it up. It's not just Radiant. We're not just weird. It's the church of God around the world. Everybody's ramping up. And the reason they're ramping up is because the attacks are so dramatic and they're working. People are losing faith. They're losing faith in their system, faith in their leaders, faith in everything. They don't, you know, think about this pandemic. What is rule number one of the pandemic? Isolation. Get in your house, stay in your house. We don't want to spread. And it has such a good, it's such a good reason behind it. We don't want to spread this disease. Therefore, get in your house and stay in your house by yourself. I mean, this is genius level attack. And I'm not saying the pandemic's not real and people didn't die. They did. It's horrifying. But this is a genius level attack from the enemy. How many people do you think broke down under isolation? Thousands and thousands. I mean, that is just an amazing attack. You know? And then the next attack. So you lost your friends and everybody because you're isolated. You're isolated and everything around you is horrifying. So you're losing your faith in God. You're questioning God. Then you got governmental leaders that are just, it's like watching the Three Stooges. I don't even know how to describe the government. It's like an episode of, you know, Laurel and Hardy or something. And you're like, I mean, so this is our version today in 2022. This is our version of what they're going through there. And of course, he's not going to back down and whisper in Aramaic to them. His whole point is fear and division and isolation. If the whole world around you has fallen, you're alone. Even as a group, you're alone. And that's how you die. Right? How you fall, how you fail. So, and they can feel that, these guys in Eliakim and Shebna, those guys, they can feel that. So that's why they tear their clothes. So I'll end today in 36 by saying the tearing their clothes part, this is part of what happens when your life is being ripped apart and you throw yourself on God's mercy, right? Symbolically, it's this whole wearing sackcloth or ripping your clothes thing that you're doing as a symbol of the hopelessness that you have as you throw yourself on the mercy of God. It's cultural, but I also believe that these guys, for the most part, have been listening to Isaiah and have been watching Hezekiah. And I don't know their individual belief systems, but I think that a lot of the core people are paying attention. They are looking at God and going, okay. And I think that when we get to 37 and Hezekiah gets the news, right? He's going to react in the same kind of way. I think that they are believers, and they're in unbelievable, just dire circumstances. But I think that God is going to fix it, and I think the reason we're getting such specifics in this section is not only do we want to know specifically how the enemy's going to act and how we're going to be attacked and how we're going to have to deal with it, right? We're getting specifics about that. But also, we're getting specifics about this time and place so that we can know with certainty this is real. Because the miracle that's going to occur is one of the biggest miracles ever in the history of the world. It's big like the parting of the Red Sea. It's big like the angel killing the Egyptians and all the plagues in Egypt. It's big like that. And it's one of the last really big giant ones like that. Because when we get to Jesus, the miracles are big, but they're not like that. And Jesus is going to change the way the world works. So this is one of the last really big, hey, look at this type of things. We're going to get some more with Babylon and some more with Daniel and some more with Cyrus. We're going to get all that stuff later. But this is one of the biggest ones ever. And so we're getting every single little detail so that we can back it up and know in our hearts that it's real and true. And God doesn't change. So here's the last thing for today. God's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. He doesn't change. He's eternal and timeless. So he doesn't change, which means that if God would do that one time, he'll do it again. If he saves people, which he does throughout the Bible over and over again in miraculous ways, And when it, whether it's a blind guy that can see with Jesus or whether it's this attack on Jerusalem, no matter what, if he does that, he'll do it again. If he's done that before, if he's taken a little guy delivering sandwiches and killed a giant, right? If he's done that before, he'll do it again. Doesn't matter. He's saved people's lives with prostitutes. He's saved people's lives with rocks. I mean, it's something he does. So we look at that and we look at all the evidence that that is real. And we go, okay. And it strengthens our faith. And we get attacked and we're like, I see this attack. I know how this works. I know how I get attacked. I get attacked like this and like that because that's how it's always been. So that means buckle down and strengthen my faith and get ready. And God's going to deliver me. So that's where we're at. So, any questions or comments about Isaiah 36? We haven't got to Hezekiah yet. So we got 36 through 39. We get this whole story. And right now, the Rabshakeh has come. And I don't know how to say it, but I think it sounds best. Like Rabshakeh. But anyway, he's come and he's said his piece and loudly instilled every ounce of fear he possibly can instill. And they do that a lot. That's what the big, you know, stone tablets are about, or the giant armies, or the way things are set up, you know. And I like how he hit every single part of it, no matter what they were thinking. Oh, Egypt's going to help us. He got that. Oh, well, God will help us. He got that. Oh, well, we got our king and our army. He got that. He hit every single thing they could possibly be relying on. Said, you know, you can't rely on any of that. But we'll see what next week. We'll see what Hezekiah does about that and what Isaiah has to say about that. Okay, let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for this day. We honor and praise your magnificent, glorious name. Lord, you are everything, and we are just in awe of you, your word, our ability to get together and study it. We're just so grateful for this time together and this day. Lord, please bless this day. Bless everyone here and everyone that would be here, could be here. Bless this church, protect our leadership, bless the sermon and meeting we're going to have, keep us safe throughout this day and this week, bless our homes and our families and our health, keep us safe and sound to come back again and continue this study. We just are in awe of you and love this chance to be together. Please give us a chance to be closer to you and have your way with our lives. Bless the service today. Bring people in from far and wide and get them to hear of you and recognize who you are. Give us a chance to represent you. And thank you. We thank you so much. Thank you, Lord. We praise your holy name. And we pray all these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen.